I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 4:25 on February 11th. Members present are Representatives Colomb, Freer, Fields, and Hall. We have a quorum. Thank you, Andrew Magnuson, the LNC Committee Secretary, and Jude Augustine from the LIO for tech and teleconferencing support. First up on the agenda is House Bill 210, Peace Officer, Firefighter Disability by Representative Kopp. We previously heard the bill. We have an amendment for consideration if Representative Sadler gets here, and we will take public testimony. So since first I want to ask, do members have any questions for either Representative Chuck Kopp or Bob Williams, Chair of the Alaska Retirement Management Board, both of whom are available for questions? Do members have questions for either Representative Kopp or Mr. Williams? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to offer public testimony on House Bill 210? Come on up.
Thank you. Okay, start.
Yes, sir, go ahead.
My name is Justin Mack, representing the Alaska Professional Firefighters and rising in support of HB 210. The Alaska Professional Firefighters represent over 500 professional fire and EMS workers across the state. HB 210 recognizes the challenging work that our public safety members are asked to do. As a 15-year firefighter with the Anchorage Fire Department and president of the Anchorage Firefighters Union, I've seen several of our members have career-ending injuries, both physical and mental health related. We're asked to respond to dangerous and unstable conditions with limited information. While we do train for these emergencies, we know that there will be injuries. Sometimes those injuries are career-ending. This bill adjusts occupational disability from 40% to 75%. We recognize that Tier 4 has limitations as far as retirement, but one of the things that is also less widely known is what Tier 4 does in the reduction for disability benefits for injured workers. Firefighters work long hours, made more challenging by an FLSA exemption and rising call volume. So this is a much-needed fix, and the Alaska Professional Firefighters urge support.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mack.
Thank
you. Do any members have questions for Mr. Mack? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer public testimony? There is no one online who wishes to offer public testimony, so that public testimony is closed. I think we can now turn to amendments. Representative Sadler, would you like to move an amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pardon me for being still getting set from the floor. Mr. Chairman, I move amendment A1, 34LS0938, /A1.
Object. Go ahead, Representative
Sadler. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for missing the initial presentation by the firefighter, but this amendment I'm offering today clearly falls within the title and the intent of the bill. Firefighters and peace officers admittedly and candidly face special vocational hazards that they should not face extraordinary financial consequences if they should have a work-related disability. This amendment, a simple amendment, he said, therefore a jinxing is only a page and a half, it expands workers' compensation disability coverage for firefighters. It does it some background first, Mr. Chairman. State law allows a presumption that firefighters who contract certain diseases and cancers, which are enumerated on page one, did so as a result of their work as firefighters, and that they are therefore should be entitled to receive workers' compensation benefits. However, the current law sets up a number of hoops that firefighters have to jump through to ensure that protection, including getting costly medical examinations for 7 years. If they miss a year, they can't qualify. This causes financial stress to departments, personal stress and expense for firefighters, and if they were to have the risk of missing one examination in that time period, they risk losing the benefits of the disability coverage. The amendment simply says that firefighters need medical exams every other year and for 6 years. This helps ensure firefighters are not unduly penalized for missing one exam early in their career, and it relieves smaller departments, even larger departments, of unnecessarily onerous ongoing medical costs. Again, I think this amendment squarely comports with the goal of the underlying bill and advances the goal to protect first responders who experience disabilities resulting from their selfless, voluntary exposure to hazards on behalf of their fellow Alaskans. And with that, I rest.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Kopp, would you mind sharing your perspective on this amendment?
Thank you, committee members and Chair Fields. Thank you, Representative Sadler, for bringing forward this amendment. So, Representative Sadler and I met on this amendment yesterday, and I assured him it certainly philosophically was in line with the spirit of this bill. After that meeting and doing a little research with my team members helping me out here, we found that the Alaska Supreme Court had a significant ruling on this issue in Adamson versus Municipality of Anchorage interpreting Alaska's firefighter presumption statute, and the court confirmed that once a firefighter meets statutory conditions, the presumption of compensability attaches. So the law already requires the onus to be on the employer to prove it wasn't related, these various diseases we're looking at, or health matters that a firefighter can come down with. The existing statute and case law do protect firefighters. The Supreme Court clarified employers cannot rebut the presumption simply by offering generalized testimony that a cancer has unknown causes. And the court reinforced our current statutory process that governs rebuttal standards. So I would just, I guess, I would like to ask the bill sponsor, we also have, you know, certainly other members here, if there is a demonstrated breakdown in this legal framework since that court ruling. Mr. Chair, am concerned about any unintended consequences, whether they be expanding into workmen's compensation issues versus just the disability benefit that we're addressing with this bill, and how those may interplay.
Okay.
I am very happy to continue to work with Representative Sadler. This is going to the Finance Committee next. Mm-hmm. And like I said, this has all been in the last several hours. These issues, it's interplay with workman's comp, that the fact that we've had a Supreme Court ruling on this, setting a standard in whether or not we would be doing something here that creates stability and clarity or not by with this amendment. So with that, I do not recommend adopting the amendment at this time.
Okay. Further questions for the amendment sponsor or sponsor of the underlying bill? Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Sadler, how long after retirement coverage lasts for presumptive coverage? How long does the coverage last for presumptive coverage, and is there a consideration for extending the coverage?
Representative Hall, my recollection is that this presumption ends, I think, at age 60, and I could be wrong, it could be 65, but my recollection is it's age 60, and no, there's a hard chronological end.
Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Nelson arrived at 4:34. I think I previously, obviously, Representative Sadler's here since he's offering an amendment. Is there further debate before taking action on the amendment, or would you like to offer closing comments?
Closing comments, appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I do recall the case. This language, admittedly, was a bill that I in the 33rd legislature got all the way to the Rules Committee and did not make it across the finish line. It had been fairly extensively vetted, and I don't have my memory, but not the black letter. But my understanding is that the case that Representative Cobb cited was fairly narrowly predicated on the subject of the lawsuit. Having had the purse capacity of getting a lot of medical examinations before the underlying law that had that presumption of coverage for these cancers and diseases. So I don't know if we can broadly apply, but as is always the case with legal decisions, it bears close examination. So I'd be glad to work with them to try and answer any concerns or questions about the broader applicability. So I'll hang back and work with them.
Okay, so you're withdrawing your amendment, it sounds like.
Well, I think I could do that if I had the opportunity to bring it forward again in the future.
Sure.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so it looks like Representative Sadler has withdrawn his amendment. Is there further debate on the underlying bill?
Chair, is the department here? Department of Administration? Who did the fiscal note?
Doesn't look like it. No.
Okay. So I just wanted to point out one thing. I mean, obviously, this is good. I want to make sure firefighters in these situations are covered. My concern is the cost, and the fiscal note's indeterminate. It also says in there that they're going to revise it because they weren't sure. First, there's the cost of the department, and then obviously there's more benefits going out, and we're in a tight fiscal situation, and I guess I could ask the bill sponsor, do you think the state can afford this increase in benefits?
Through the chair, Representative Colom, yes. And the reason why I say yes unequivocally is how significantly overfunded, well-funded the trust balances are. Mm-hmm. So if we look at the PERS Disability Trust Fund is $98.9 million, mm-hmm. and TERS is $9.8 million. Of course, we're not talking about teachers. I guess they have fewer injuries, so it's a lower balance. But for PERS, $98.9 million, and that is considered to be significantly overfunded. Our initial request on this and the very few numbers of public safety people that are actually out on disability indicate that it is no threat to the disability funding status at the rate the contributions are required to come into it.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Colom. Representative Carrick is here at 437. If the committee members are okay with it, I'm going to reopen public testimony. Obviously, we got started late due to floor, and right after I closed public testimony, three more individuals called in. Is there any objection to that? If not, I'm going to reopen public testimony and take testimony online. First up is Michael O'Connor. Mr. O'Connor, please go ahead with your public testimony.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I appreciate your time. And can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. So my name is Michael O'Connor. I worked for the Anchorage Police Department for 11 years and was injured in the line of duty. In 2022, I separated from employment under disability and have been receiving disability from the state of Alaska since that time. Regarding House Bill 210, I appreciate that moving forward and addressing the lack of support that injured first responders receive when they serve the communities of Alaska. I do have two other acquaintances that are on the line as well, and they will speak to their instance. But I wanted to talk about HB 210 and potential options moving forward. We understand that the new proposal is 75% of an individual's salary once they are deemed disabled by the state of Alaska. We really appreciate that, and I think we're moving in the right direction. I would like to add that many, many people who get injured in the line of duty go out on FMLA or workers' compensation where they receive a significant reduction in pay in their prior 12 months before separation of employment. In my specific example, I was on FMLA for 10 months, which meant I was receiving 80% of my base salary. So currently, a disability is based on your prior 12 months of pay, and it's at 40%. Moving forward with the 75%, I would like the committee to consider looking at the employee's previous high three and making an average, so that would still include the portion of time where they were receiving a reduced wage, and incorporating that into the 75%. Another option that I think is definitely viable is a reduction of that 75% to 50% of the individual's high three salary, but making that for life. We have a lot of employees, or not a lot, but a majority of the employees have between 6 to 8 years on. I had 11, another had 14 who I'm aware of. But with the 25-year mark where you stop receiving disability benefits, there's still a lot of life left. Additionally, the requirement where disabled or individuals receiving the disability have to reapply annually causes undue stress, financial uncertainty for those who are injured while serving and protecting the citizens of Alaska. It has also caused members to not be able to receive loans because they can't show a positive income or consistent income stream. And you know, we definitely appreciate the moving forward and the recognition of the lack of support disabled employees are receiving. And I welcome the conversation, and I look forward to working with the committee and sharing our thoughts and our experiences navigating this system over the last couple of years, which has been very challenging. And I know we're short on time, and so with that, I'll open up any questions if any members of the committee have any questions for me, and we'll...
Okay. Any questions for Mr. O'Connor? And we do have other testifiers as well. Okay. Thank you, Mr. O'Connor, for your testimony. Next up is Robert Teeling. Mr. Teeling, please go ahead with your testimony.
Yes. Thank you so much for all of us and hearing us. I would like to add on to Michael Connor's testimony. My name is Robert Teeling. I was a Alaska State Trooper for 6 years, injured in the line of duty. And like Mr. O'Connor stated, the 40% is based on the last basically base pay of the employee when they went out, their 12 months. And I just wanted to kind of add something into this. It's first off, the yearly checkups are definitely undue stress simply for the fact that doctors do change, doctors move. Alaska is not one of the easiest places to get a doctor to see you continually. And with mine, it was messed up twice. So now not only am I doing this every 12 months, I already did it, and I'm also due now in March. So I've only had 6 months in between my two checkups and my evaluations, which means that my financial state is up in the air again here in a couple months. But I'd also like to add in there, and this is not just a hypothetical, this is an actual reality that could set in, especially with the Alaska State Troopers. Troopers are typically moved to bush communities in which they're in state housing, and oftentimes they'll, if they don't bring their vehicles with them, those vehicles will be sold before they leave. Oftentimes spouses will have to leave their line of work in order to move with their trooper to a bush community and live in state housing. Now, if you have a trooper that is injured while they're out in a bush community and they don't have any home set outside of state housing, after they have been deemed that they're no longer able to return to their line of work, then those individuals now are faced with the fact that now their spouse no longer has 2 years worth of verifiable income to get a mortgage on a home or to get another vehicle or, for that matter, any loans. So now that individual, after they leave the bush community, they're basically homeless, and there will be no verifiable income for that individual. Now, some employees, when they leave the state work with their injuries, might be able to go on and get another line of work. Others will not be able to do so. And so now you've basically taken a trooper that has moved for the state into a bush community and served the state of Alaska and is now injured, which I could say that bush troopers are probably more likely to be injured than some of the road posts simply for the fact that they have no backup and they're going to falls alone. And now they're forced to try to figure out how to get a mortgage, how to get a house or whatever it is, car, to try to restart their life with no verifiable income and 40% of their salary that most likely came off of FMLA, which was 80% reduction in their pay. So that is not just a hypothetical, that's a reality that is definitely something that the state probably will face in the future if they have not already. I don't know every individual that has been out on disability, but that's just something that has come up. The other thoughts on the yearly, there's other places, other states, that'll do a 1 to 2 year evaluation, and then after that, they receive it until they're 25. Now, speaking on the 25 years, it's 25 years from your start date. So if now if you take a trooper that's 21 years old when they start, they've put no money into Social Security, especially if they went from high school with no job putting into Social Security, then they went on to college with no money put into Social Security from another job. Now they get on with the state of Alaska that has opted out of Social Security. So now those individuals are no longer eligible for Social Security benefits, and that includes Social Security and the disability that comes along with that. So basically, you've taken an individual that has their life, in a sense, for the state, and now they are basically left in whatever state the state of Alaska decides to leave them in, which in so far with the individuals that I do know, is not a very good state. So those are some things that to think about when you're looking at this bill. 75% definitely would help, and like Mike O'Connor stated, the salary based on the high three for that basis would be a substantial increase. And then if the state was able to do the either 1 year or 2 year verifiable injury, and then that became a verifiable, if they were able to get rid of those checkups and make it so it's something that it can be utilized for verifiable income, then those individuals could potentially go out and get a mortgage or find a home or at least try to restart their life. Those are some of the things that have come up as we've navigated the system. And like Mike said, if anybody has any questions further on this, we're more than happy to help out with that, with what we've kind of studied and what we've been through. And with that, I will turn the floor over to Scott if there's no questions.
Any other question?
There is a question from Representative Sadler, Mr. Teeling, if you have a second.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Keeling. Is it Keeling or Teeling? I'm sorry.
It's Mr. Keeling. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
That's okay. That's good. No, Mr. Keeling. You said that you were a state trooper and have been injured on the job. You're currently on disability status. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And how long has that condition persisted, if I may ask?
Sir, I was injured in 2022. I received a traumatic brain injury. There's really not anything that's going to fix it. We've been trying. I've been doing everything I possibly can to get it as good as I can. But as you know, law enforcement and first responders typically require a typically more I don't know how to say it, but basically they have to be pretty quick on their feet, which this injury has taken from me. So, yes, 3 years, sir.
Okay, very good. And follow up, you'd said that you mentioned that your checkups are onerous. What is, I don't know if I can ask for everybody, what is necessary for you to have the annual checkup or annual medical examination? A lot of visits, a lot of tests? What does that constitute?
It constitutes visiting your general practitioner as well as whatever the state deems that they want. So it could be another psychological assessment just to basically state that you still cannot be a police officer. And it's also good to note that in order for me to receive the disability benefits, I was told by a retirement disability that I had to meet the threshold of never being able to be a peace officer again. And so my confusion on that is if I've already reached that level of never being able to be a peace officer, be able to be a peace officer again, and I met that in the first year, then why use the term never, which typically means ever? Every single year I have to now reprove that I can still never be something that I've already proven that I can never be.
Just to clarify, follow up to clarify.
Yes.
And so it said the annual requirement is a visit to your general practitioner and maybe some additional examinations what the state wants, is there automatically another examination?
That's correct. It's kind of whatever they decide they want, then you kind of get put on hold until what I was told early on is that they send your packet or your medical records or whatnot to begin with out to some agency or whoever I don't know where it was. Pennsylvania, I think, is what they said. And so it goes off to an independent review, and they review it, and then you're kind of put on hold. For some, it's a week before you find out. Others, it's been a month. I think Mr. O'Connor waited almost over a month to find out whether or not he was going to get his next year's pay or not.
Very good. Thank you. And we can hear you much more clearly at the end. Thank you so much.
Okay. Next up in public testimony, thank you, Mr. Teeling, is Scott Lanier. Mr. Lanier, please proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Scott Lanier. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for having the opportunity to speak with the board today. I was an Alaska State Trooper that was hired in 2010. I was stationed all over the state, Mattoo Valley, Coldfoot, King Salmon, and Fairbanks. I understand that my time is limited, but I just kind of want to cover some of the, as the other guys submitted our kind of recommendations to the board. I just wanted to kind of go over the the process that that I've gone through the last couple of years becoming a disabled trooper. I was injured in 2019 in the pursuit of an armed individual in the Fairbanks area. I ultimately blew my ankle apart and had to have multiple surgeries where after each individual surgery, I returned to full duty. The first one, I was back for a year and a half. Then the injury failed. I had to have a second repair done. I returned to full duty, and that repair lasted 6 months. And then I ultimately had to have my ankle replaced. Before I had the replacement surgery, I did a little bit of research to the disability program and what someone might be entitled. I contacted the HR representative from DPS and asked about the manual so I could read up on it, and I was told that there is no manual. All there was a chart in the Tier 4 website that states that must be totally and presumably permanently disability whose calls were directly related to the performance of their duties of the job or on-the-job injury. The benefit is 40% of the salary, earned service while on occupational disability, no medical insurance until eligible for normal retirement. The employer continues to make all required contributions as if from the member's disability payment. Disability benefits will cease when the member becomes eligible for normal retirement at Medicare eligible age and 10 years of service, or at any age with 25 years of service for peace officers. So for peace officers, our disability stops at 25 years of service. But for a regular person on Tier 4, their disability stops at 30 years. So why is our disability stopping 5 years before somebody that doesn't do the line of duty injuries that we might be capable of? In April of 2024, my doctors notified me that they would not be clearing me for duty based on my replaced ankle joint. I notified the Alaska State Trooper Command, and on April the 11th in 2024, I was given a choice to resign, take an administrative separation, or be terminated by DPS Human Resources. I chose to take the administrative separation, but I had to handwrite in there that I was taking this due to a work-related injury. In 2024 of April, I applied for disability through the Department of Retirement and Benefits. This process was very difficult to navigate as there's no one to assist the injured employee along the way. I was forced to do my own research and figure it out. Requests for information from disability were often ignored and very often incorrect. I kept advocating for myself and finally was approved and received back pay until May of 2024. I'm currently receiving Tier 4 disability pay. I receive a little over $3,900 a month. I was given the option for COBRA health insurance, which costs $1,700 a month. So almost half my salary was based on medical coverage, which I could not afford. I'm currently not working. I spoke to numerous attorneys during this process and to see if I needed to be representative, and I was told that an Alaska statute did not allow a workman's comp attorney to get involved until my workman's comp case was disputed, in which my case was never disputed, so therefore I received no legal representation. When I received my last paycheck from the state, I sold back all my personal leave, and I found out that I was 6 months short on my personal leave. That I sold back to the state. When I got that check, I said, hey, my pay's a little bit short. And that's when they told me that they stopped paying me 6 months ago. They said that there was a provision in the contract that only let employees that were injured in the line of duty only to be paid for 1 year from their time of injury. Well, in that case, I had already returned to work numerous times after multiple surgeries, and I was on my third surgery, and they decided not to pay me anymore. So I spent my last 6 months on personal leave. So how can somebody that was injured in the line of duty protecting Alaskans in the state have to pay their last year or last 6 months of salary out of their own pocket to get an injury repaired? My disability was ultimately approved. I was told my calculation was done for the last year, but in my case, they told me specifically that I was only calculated from January of 2024 until April of 2024. So I didn't even get the whole credit of the whole year. If the pay was calculated from the actual time of injury, I was a sergeant making 50% more money in king salmon due to geographical difference, and I was also overtime eligible. I also feel that the overtime should be calculated into the disability, as most troopers in law enforcement have mandatory overtime requirements. And if someone's required to work overtime, that should be also included into their disability calculations, not just based on their base salary. In June of 2024, I received an email from the disability unit. The email was sent to me by mistake, and it was intended to be an in-house email between disability staff. This email called me names, including a bully, and stated I was difficult to work with. This email also mentioned that I wanted to speak to her supervisor because she kept repeatedly giving me wrong information. This email also mentioned that I was going to be difficult to work with during my yearly applications, as I was a highly aggressive individual. I had to file a complaint with the supervisor of the disability unit for unprofessionalism. How can I possibly be treated fair and impartially if this is how their staff is treating me before I'm even on disability? In November of 2024, the state had still not contributed to our defined benefit plan as required. And this was not just me, this was multiple people. I filed numerous complaints of the notification of this discrepancy, including the state ombudsman's office and the governor's chief of staff, which I was never returned a call. The ombudsman's office gave me a phone number and closed my complaint as resolved, even though I never spoke to any. I've contacted Public Safety Employees Union, Association Union, and I've had them say that I'm no longer an employee or part of the union. I've contacted the Retirement of Benefits for them to say that I'm technically not an employee, nor I'm technically not retired, so they're unable to help. The only people I'm able to talk to is the disability unit. And the disability unit doesn't even have a phone number that I can call and talk to somebody. All my correspondence has to be done via email or certified mail. There needs to be something that changes with that very soon, because I can't even call to say I didn't even get paid correctly this month for them to say, oh, yeah, we missed something. No, it takes 3 to 4 weeks to get a reply from the disability unit for just even a simple thing that's a problem with pay. During this time, I tried to take a distribution from my deferred compensation because I was without a lot of salary. I was trying to pay some bills. And I was also told that the state of Alaska put a hold on all my retirement accounts, and I was not able to access any of my money, even my deferred compensation plan. I couldn't even get anyone to answer my phone calls about that, and ultimately had to get the deputy commissioner of DPS to finally get me on board with some of the directors of admin to get it corrected. It finally has been corrected, and they finally have made whole on our deferred or our retirement contributions. My workman's comp claim was ultimately settled for $26,000. That's all they said my time was worth and my leg was worth. And now I have to walk with an external prosthetic so that I can walk on a daily basis without pain. 6.5 years later, I finally got that. So to put it bluntly, I kind of find the Tier 4 disability program to be a little bit, kind of a slap on the face and kind of very unprofessional when dealing with them. For someone to put their life on the line daily for Alaskans to lose 60% of their salary with no medical for getting injury, there are problems with this program that I'm sure I'm barely scratching the surface. And these are just some of the problems that I experienced. Others have similar stories but can't talk about their stories yet because they're still in, maybe in some sort of litigation. The state of Alaska considers me permanently partially disabled, yet disability has an expiration date of 25 years for ice and fire, and I have to reapply every year. What's permanent about this?
Mr. Lanier, I apologize for interjecting, but we do have another bill to go through and another testifier. Is it possible to wrap up your testimony, please?
Yep, I'm on my last thing. I'm still dealing with this injury today, 6.5 years later. Yet to this day, I still cannot get a loan. I'm still living on my $3,900 a month, and I'm hoping someone will listen and help make this right. I think you guys are listening now, and I appreciate you guys for listening. I feel that we should also maybe help some with some sort of advocacy program for the people that are going through this. I'm willing to answer any specific questions. Thank you for hearing my time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lanier. We have one more testifier, Chief Schrage from the Anchorage Fire Department. Chief Schrage, go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chair Fields, for, first of all, for reopening public testimony and for hearing this bill today. And also, I'd like to express my gratitude to Representative Kopp for bringing this bill and for the prior legislatures that have done work on this. I'm the fire chief in the city of Anchorage for the Anchorage Fire Department, and I come to you today briefly in support of House Bill 210, and I offer the employer's perspective. Firefighters and police officers, as we all know, work in high-risk environments. They're exposed to physical demands and are exposed routinely to long-term health risks. And when our public safety professionals are making decisions or taking actions in the field that potentially expose themselves to these risks or increase their exposure to these risks, they shouldn't have to worry about whether they will be taken care of should they be injured in the line of duty. And so for these reasons, and for the reasons that you've heard from others already, I am in support of the bill. Happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks, Chief Schrage. With that, I'm going to close public testimony. Those are all the remaining testifiers. We do need to move efficiently because we have another bill. We're going to be done by 5:30. Bob Williams wanted to briefly address the committee, and then we can take action on this bill. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Williams, and I serve as chair of the Alaska Retirement Management Board. The board has not taken a position on House Bill 210. However, in the last hearing of HB 210, the board's work on defined contribution disability coverage came up in conversation, and I was asked to provide additional context. In 2025, the Armed Board heard direct testimony on multiple occasions from defined contribution members receiving occupational disability who described the stress of being disabled without health care coverage. That testimony prompted the board to look more closely at the broader disability structures within defined contribution system, specifically the absence of health care coverage during disability and the absence of non-occupational disability coverage. Current law for defined contribution members only covers occupational disability, disabilities occurring in the line of duty, and approximately 85% of disabilities are non-occupational. These members receive neither income replacement nor post-employment health care coverage. For those members who do qualify for occupational disability, health care coverage ends when the employment terminates. A firefighter seriously injured in a structure fire may survive but be unable to return to work. That individual would receive some income replacement but would not have health care coverage until normal retirement age, currently 65. Defined benefit members, by comparison, receive both disability income and health care coverage during disability. The Armed Board's Resolution 2025-22 recommends that the legislature, one, add non-occupational disability income coverage for defined contribution members with at least 10 years of service, two, add health care coverage for defined contribution members while on occupational or non-occupational disability. Occupational disability would have no service requirements. Non-occupational disability would require 10 years of covered service. The board asked our independent review actuary, Gabriel Roeder, Smith & Company, to evaluate whether the defined contribution disability and retirement medical trusts could sustain closing these gaps. The GRS actuarial memo included in the resolution 2025-22 found the defined contribution trusts are strongly funded. All four trusts remain above 100% funded under all modeled scenarios.
Okay.
These changes require only modest adjustments to normal cost. The combined increase to PERS defined contribution, which includes police and fire, is approximately 0.2% of payroll. For TERS defined contribution, the increase is approximately 0.1% of payroll. As you look at defined contribution and disability coverage, I thought that this might be additional context that you'd want to know about. Thank you.
Thank you for following up. Do members have further questions before we take action on the bill? Yeah. Representative Sadler.
First, Mr. Chairman, I just want to confirm. I asked, we were considering my amendment, if I would have the opportunity to work with the sponsor on the amendment. I was assuming that meant in this committee. I was hoping, I asked if I would preserve the opportunity to work with
them. Oh, okay. That was my misunderstanding, Representative Sadler. I meant in a subsequent committee or at a future stage of the bill.
I don't sit on, though.
What's that?
That I don't sit on.
Oh, with you anyway.
Sure, yeah. Representative Cotter.
Yeah.
And just closing, I do want to restate that I appreciate Representative Sadler bringing up the workman's comp piece, which is the insurance end, and then the disability benefits is the cash payment end. But together we see a system that has completely failed our people. The one trooper with the TBI didn't tell us, but he was nearly beaten to death in Fairbanks. That's how he got a TBI. These injuries are life-changing. And it's people that put it all on the line every day. And his experience with DRB, you know, I had a close officer that I buried. He died on Christmas Day, shot and killed. And the finance people actually debited back out of his wife's account the last 5 days of the year because he wasn't alive to work. So he got paid through the end of the year, and that money came back out, and we went to war over that, got that fixed. But it tells you when you don't experience things on a visceral level, it's just kind of a, you know, it's just ethereal and abstract. But these are real people, real families we're talking about. And our system, I'm addressing a very narrow part, not everything Mr. Williams talking about. I'm just talking about what we're paying. Disability is 40% for the first year. We're not changing that. It's just 75% in subsequent years. And you have to re-verify that you're disabled every year. So, and that's what I appreciate about Mr. Sadler mentioning the workman's comp, because the re-verification is an issue there too, and the frequency of it, and I'm very pleased to work with him on that.
Okay,
and I regret the misunderstanding we had, but with the good faith declaration by the sponsor that we will work on that and try and get it in.
Okay, and sorry for the misunderstanding, Representative Sadler. Okay, Representative Hall, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move to report HB 210 version LS0938/A out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Not seeing any objection. House Bill 210 is reported from committee, and we will take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and bring up the next bill in today's hearing. At ease. Back on the record, next up is Representative Mina and her staff to present very briefly summary of changes, House Bill 195, Pharmacist Prescription Authority.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Genevieve Mina. I represent House District 19, the Anchorage neighborhoods of Airport Heights, Mountain View, and Russian Jack. Thank you for the second hearing of House Bill 195. Over the interim, our stakeholders work really diligently to integrate a lot of different feedback from many different providers in the healthcare sector. We are presenting a committee substitute today, and my staff, Katie Giorgio, will go over the explanation of changes for that CS.
Katie Giorgio, for the record. Explanation of changes. So you had before you last May version A and the draft CS before you today, which is labeled version N. The significant changes, which are four. Section 1 adds a new section that prohibits the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, also known as DCCED, from requiring fees for collaborative practice agreements, requiring board approval for those collaborative practice agreements, or from defining the nature or scope of those agreements, but also requires that each collaborative practice agreement clearly defines the specific patient care services the pharmacist is permitted to provide under that agreement. Section 7 is amended to bring some clarity to let me back up. This is one of the suggestions that we took from meetings with the State Medical Association, and Section 7 is amended so that the pharmacist may not make any new diagnosis for someone who comes in to see them, but it does maintain that if they are doing what's called a CLIA wave test, they may diagnose something new through that process. Section 8 is regarding controlled substances. Again, bringing some clarity to basically show that what we were trying to get to is we're not having pharmacists prescribe opioids unless it is specifically for medication-assisted therapy in a clinical setting. And Section 13 updates the effective date to January 1st, 2027. And that concludes the explanation of changes.
Okay, so with that explanation, Representative Hall, would you like to make a motion to adopt the proposed CS?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee substitute for HB 195, work draft 34-LS0909/N as a working document.
Is there objection? Okay.
I'd like to get a copy of that CS if I can, please. I don't have the book.
Sure. We'll get you a copy of that, Representative Sadler. Not seeing any objection, we have adopted the CS. At this time, I might suggest that we turn to invited testifiers. Okay. First up is Dr. Brandy Signamartin with the Alaska Pharmacy Association. Dr. Signamartin, thank you for being here, and sorry we're running late.
All right. Well, good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. Thank you so much for having me here today. For the record, my name is Dr. Brandy Signamartin. I'm a pharmacist by training. I serve as the executive director of the Alaska Pharmacy Association and a clinical assistant professor at the UAA ISU Doctor of Pharmacy program. Last session, I did come testify in front of this body in support, and thank you so much for hearing the bill again today. At that time, I spoke to the role about the role pharmacists already play across the health system in Alaska, the importance of using the standard of care framework, and how this legislation could responsibly expand access to routine healthcare services without compromising safety. I'd like to recap some of the work that we did over the interim and some pieces of the legislation. So we met four times. Is this microphone working?
Yes.
Okay. We met four times, totaling approximately 6 hours with members of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy, the Alaska State Medical Association, and the Alaska Pharmacy Association. Representative Justin Ruffridge did attend several of those meetings. We also worked closely with our bill sponsors carefully revise the legislation. These conversations were substantive and detailed. Concerns were raised about whether the authority in the bill might be unlimited, whether pharmacists would be broadly diagnosing new conditions, and whether this legislation would allow pharmacists to hang their own shingle as independent diagnostic practices. We took those concerns very seriously. The committee substitute before you reflects meaningful tightening of the language. This is not unlimited authority. Pharmacists must practice within a narrow lane already in law, within their education, training, and experience, and under the standard of care framework. And when a condition falls outside of that narrow lane or the pharmacist's competency, referral is required, just as it is today. During those discussions, there was also acknowledgement, including guidance from the Department of Law, that if the legislation intends pharmacists to provide these patient care services, as were passed in 2022 in House Bill 145, it's absolutely critical that the words prescribe and administer appear in the statutory section titled Other Patient Care Services. Without those terms, the authority becomes unclear, legally unworkable, and including them is not an expansion of scope. It's a matter of statutory clarity. One of the areas that we found genuine alignment with the medical association in those conversations was around collaborative practice. So there's kind of two lanes of practice in this bill. There's the collaborative practice piece, and then there's the independent authority piece. So there was a shared recognition that Alaska would benefit from more meaningful, functional collaborative practice agreements. Pharmacists are well positioned to support higher levels of care when working within team-based models, particularly in chronic disease state management and medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, which remains an urgent need across our state. Currently, collaborative practice agreements in Alaska are not truly functional, and there's not a pathway for pharmacists to participate in opioid use disorder treatment. The regulatory structure makes them difficult to operationalize, and as a result, they're underutilized. Section 1 of this committee substitute helps remedy that by making those agreements workable in practice. That change is not about independent authority. It is about strengthening team-based care. In fact, during our discussions, we talked about the opportunity, should this bill pass, to host a joint summit focused specifically on collaborative practice. The goal would be to bring pharmacists and physicians together to build innovative team-based care models to work intentionally on shifting the culture toward more interdisciplinary collaboration. In addition to strengthening collaborative models, this bill allows pharmacists to address routine conditions within clearly defined guardrails. By managing predictable, lower acuity care, pharmacists can help reduce friction in the system and free physicians to focus on complex diagnostics, procedures, and higher-level care management, where their expertise is most needed. Though I cannot speak to where our friends at the Medical Association will ultimately land on this bill, I can say the process was thoughtful and conducted in good faith. The version before you reflects meaningful efforts to address concerns while preserving the bill's intent. We actually just heard testimony from a former state trooper who said, Alaska is not the easiest place to consistently have a physician see you. testament to one of the reasons why we need this bill. It's important to center this conversation on the fact that this type of authority is not new. Pharmacists in the federal system, including the VA, Indian Health Service, and tribal health organizations across Alaska, have practiced at this level for decades. In multiple other states and many countries around the world, pharmacists are already providing care for minor, routine conditions safely and effectively under similar frameworks. The data consistently show comparable outcomes, high patient satisfaction, and lower overall cost of care. But sometimes the value of this bill is best understood through very practical examples. So last week we were here for our legislative fly-in, and I was able to sit in on some meetings with my colleague who's the district manager for the Fred Meyer Pharmacies, and he really laid out a routine thing that he sees commonly. A parent comes in with a prescription for a nebulizer solution for their child, but no nebulizer device. Today, the pharmacist must call the provider's office, leave a message, wait for a response, leads to delays in care, right? While administrative back and forths occur, the provider's office, already stretched thin, must field that call and generate another prescription. Under this bill, in an appropriate circumstance, the pharmacist could resolve that issue in real time. The child receives timely care, the provider's office avoids unnecessary administrative burden, and the system works more efficiently. I also heard from my colleague, who is the director of pharmacy at YKHC, that during Typhoon Heilong, if this policy had been in place, their team would have been able to more efficiently handle and support patients right there as they were getting evacuated to Bethel. So, in conclusion, this bill is not about replacing physicians. It's not about creating parallel healthcare systems. It is about responsibly leveraging the infrastructure that already exists in communities across Alaska. Pharmacies that are accessible, trusted, and already deeply integrated into patient care to close routine gaps and reduce friction in the system. The version of HB 195 before you reflects months of thoughtful discussion, careful revision. It reinforces guardrails, strengthens collaborative practice, ensures statutory clarity, and preserves the integrity of team-based care. Most importantly, it gives Alaskans the opportunity to use its healthcare workforce more effectively in service of patients. This legislation is supported by the Alaska Healthcare and Hospital Association, the Alaska Native Health Board, the Alaska Doctor of Pharmacy Program, and chief medical officers at many of the tribal health organizations around the state, including South Central Foundation and Tanana Chiefs Conference, who we've heard testimony from in previous hearings. So on behalf of the Alaska Pharmacy Association, I respectfully urge your support of House Bill 195, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Good. And I'm going to suggest that we go to the second invited testifier, Dr. Ashley Schaber, and then circle back for questions. I believe Dr. Schaber is available on Teams. Dr. Schaber, please proceed with your testimony.
Hi, good afternoon, Co-Chair Fields, Co-Chair Hall, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ashley Schaber, and I'm presenting today on behalf of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy. House Bill 195 is the result of several years spanning multiple Board of Pharmacy chairs as we've reviewed our statutes and regulations to align our licensee authority with their education, training, and experience. The ultimate goal is to increase access to care. As mentioned, a previous bill passed in 2021 and 2022, and this added a new section of pharmacy statutes called Other Patient Care Services, recognizing that pharmacists provide services other than traditional medication dispensing, both under collaborative practice agreements or independently. After this statute was added, the board received multiple questions from businesses and licensees, so it was determined in collaboration with the Department of Law that clarification was needed, specifically in regards to pharmacists prescribing and administering. House Bill 195 increases access to pharmacists provided patient care services while aligning state statute and pharmacy education and training. The bill encourages interdisciplinary engagement between pharmacists and other healthcare practitioners. It gives pharmacists statutory authority to establish models of care that have been proven effective. And as mentioned, since you last heard the bill in the committee, representatives of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy, the Alaska Pharmacy Association, and the Alaska Medical Association have met several times to discuss the legislation. Common goals were identified, and the committee substitute introduced today reflects that collaboration with and input from the Alaska Medical Association. In conclusion, on behalf of the Alaska Board of Pharmacy, I request your support of House Bill 195, and thank you for the opportunity to present today.
Thank you, Dr. Schaber. In addition to the two invited testifiers, Tom Wadsworth, who is the dean of the UAA School of Pharmacy, is also online for questions. Are there questions for Dr. Signamartin or Dr. Schaber or Dr. Wadsworth or the bill sponsor? Okay. Seeing no questions, the amendment deadline for this bill is 10 a.m. Friday, February 13th. In addition to that, we were going to have a hearing, a second hearing on HB 293, Jeanette Counselor Licensing. The main purpose of that was to for you all to hear from asthma testifiers about that organization's support for the bill. So we will bring them back hopefully on Friday. Are members comfortable setting an amendment deadline now, or do you have more things that you want to think about with respect to genetic counselors?
Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate more time. It's a new area of medical practice and certainly new to me, so I'd appreciate time enough to consider. It's a long...
Sure.
So, yeah, more time's good.
Yeah, I'm fine setting an amendment deadline after the next hearing if that's okay with people. Okay. I think that covers everything at 5:23. House Labor and Commerce is adjourned.